I think I said several times in the past two evenings that taste was a word that was in bad odor nowadays. And it's compromised by its association with and connotation of things like tastefulness, good taste, fashion, politeness, so forth. But still there's no better term for what it means. The word taste came in the discussion of art late in the 17th century, and it was much used in the 18th century. And the 18th century was, as I think we can see the further it recedes in the time, signally tough-minded period. And the use of the word taste met head-on certain crucial questions about art that have tended to be dodged more or less since then. Questions about what's most pertinent to art experience, what's decisive in art experience, who's entitled to express an opinion on art, what to make of disagreements about value in art. And above all, the issue which is not an issue, really, but has tended to be burked, that is the fact that taste is indispensable. An eye, an ear, a nose, indispensable in dealing with art, whether as a maker of it or as a receiver of it. There's no getting around what taste means, whatever other word you might choose to use in place of taste. But somehow, since the 18th century, it's not considered proper to go on about taste in public and about its necessity, about the necessity of having an eye, an ear, a nose, about the the implicit necessity of being able to see before you sound off on art, being able to hear before you sound off on music. Grant Allen, a fairly well-known British philosopher of aesthetics of the late 19th century, said he felt it was an advantage not to have taste in writing about art, because then you didn't get distracted by your likes and dislikes. And it is a fact that treatises on aesthetics since the early 19th century have tended to dodge the question, and even more the question about disagreements of taste. And even Croce, who is the only writer on aesthetics I really respect after Kant, uses double talk when it comes to the question of taste and disagreements about taste. And it's typical that someone as intelligent and knowing and alert in the best sense, knowing in the best sense too, as Suzanne Langer, leaves the question entirely unmentioned in the three books she devotes to art, or devotes in large part to art. And somehow you recognize that Dr. Suzanne isn't big league for that reason. You know, as bright and smart and as articulate as she is, she dodges this big question of disagreements of taste and who acquires taste. The thing that someone, and that's the measure of how much better Kant was, that he runs into it and won't dodge it. It bothers him. Oh, he comes back to it again and again in his Critique of Aesthetic Judgment. How the devil is it that we agree about taste, and why is it that taste is so necessary, and so forth. There's a survey of aesthetics, Gilbert and Kuhn's History of Aesthetics, and it's a pretty good survey, where the whole question of taste, the sensibility, discrimination, disappears in the disappears in the last 200 pages of this 600-page book. That is, it disappears after the name, after Kant is discussed. And yet the question of taste remained and remains as crucial as it ever was, and the informal talk about among artists and among art lovers and art buffs revolves around it. And if anything, it revolves around this question even more than before. But still, there's still a great deal of fear, great deal of coyness about putting on the line the question of who has taste and who hasn't, and how indispensable it is. And a symptom of this is that over the last 50 years, not just over the last 20 years, as some of us might think, it's become taken as a matter of course not to expect to have art critics to be able to see. They're expected to be commentators, idea men, sloganeers, phrase makers, ideologues, but not connoisseurs. When an art critic explicitly discriminates quality, and above all when he goes into detail about quality, within a specific work of art, that is when he exerts his taste, he's taken to be old-fashioned. And one eminent American art critic has said that telling the difference between good and bad in art is the business of reviewers. The art critic proper deals with the connection between art and culture, which is a really serious question compared to, let's say, discriminating between Picasso and, I have to use that name again, Norman Rockwell. Poor Norman Rockwell, because there are no more popular artists whom we know by name than we use as the whipping boy. And I tell you, it's a real loss in making a point, just as the fact nobody here remembers who Eddie Guest was. Handicaps me in making a point about certain points about poetry. Now, a lot of the nonsense and the muddlement in art writing, and I'm sure everyone here who has ever read, who has read an art magazine, must know what I mean when I talk about the muddlement, the inflated rhetoric, the incoherence of art writing. Much of this stems from the feeling on the part of the writer, and sometimes on the part, well, on the part of too many of his readers too, that you don't have to tie yourself to an aesthetic judgment, that you can vapor on, you can write with greater freedom. If you don't have taste, if you don't commit yourself to value judgments, the way Apollinaire felt. Apollinaire, William Guillaume Apollinaire, was by way of being a great poet, and he becomes celebrated in retrospect as an art critic for championing the Cubists. But he started the tradition of aggressively bad art writing that afflicts us today. And he couldn't see very well. Certain people at the time knew that Apollinaire couldn't see very well. He may have had a nose of sorts, but sometimes he had a cold and his nose was stuffed. But his eyes were never clear. Well, the tradition of rhetoric that he founded is the dominant tradition in art writing today. I won't say it's the exclusive one, but it's the dominant one. And it depends above all on the fact that the question of taste is considered too trivial to be admitted. And yet, the questions come back in. The question, not the questions. Value judgments sneak back in unacknowledgedly, surreptitiously, inadvertently. The art writer, the art lecturer, intends to leave them out, but he's too confused to know when they come in. And at the same time, he goes on writing and talking as if value judgments didn't come in. And he goes on writing and talking as if the question of comparative value judgments were indecent. And all this reproduces the confusion of the normal art writer's mind. The normal art writer is confused in our time. And the fact is that most art writers are culls. They're people usually who wouldn't be able to survive writing about anything else. And I mean that in all seriousness. It's not my opinion alone. I won't insist on that. And all the same, the main question in art, the first question in art is, which are the works of art that we are to pay the most attention to and continue paying the most attention to? And which are the works of art that in a showdown we're to pay less attention to? And this is the main question, the main practical question, I mean. And this question is decided by taste, just as it always has been. It's decided by mistaken taste, or it's decided by correct taste. But it is decided by taste. And it's taste that the conversation, the shop talk of artists continues, as I've said, to revolve around as much as ever. It's taste that they talk of art lovers and of art critics and of art buffs revolves around. The real talk about art, the informal talk, the talk that alas doesn't reach print very often. And it remains that without the application of taste, there's no talking about art as art. You can talk about art without the application of taste, but when you're doing that, you're talking about art as a document or a record, as evidence, historical, psychological, or moral evidence, philosophical, sociological, political, and so forth, as clue to states of mind, to the ethos of a people, to the mood of a culture or a civilization. But you're not talking about art qua art. And in so far as you're talking about art as a document or as a record, bad art serves almost, in most cases, serves just as well, and in some cases serves even better than good art. That is, a bad Italian picture of the 16th century probably tells you more about culture in North and Central Italy than a Michelangelo or a Titian does. And at the same time, other things than art provide you with evidence about culture. Art becomes one piece of evidence among others, and doesn't function in its uniqueness when we use art as evidence. When we use art the radiator doesn't bother me, but does it give you any trouble in hearing me? It does? Quality or value, and I don't think right now I have to specify what I mean by it. Quality is what gives art its unique value. It's what makes art irreplaceable. And taste is the only thing that gives us access art, the irreplaceability of art. Quality is constituted by the pleasure, joy, exhilaration, delight, elation, affect, the satisfaction gotten from art, and quality in its turn, satisfaction in its turn, constitute art, constitutes art, makes art art, the poorest as well as the best art. And everything that's in art, the content, the import, the tenor, the drift, the meaning, the significance, all of which words are stabs, all these things are carried by quality. And the more taste you possess, the more quality you recognize, the more satisfaction you get from art, the more strictly and the more sharply you're able to discriminate quality, the more even you get out of bad art. People, the question of bad art, which the philosophers of aesthetics since Kant have tended to get rid of by saying, well, bad art is not really art. That's what Croce says. And many other philosophers of aesthetics, well, in saying that, and it's commonly said, you know, if it's bad, it's not art. Well, that's a cop-out. Often people, all too often people enjoy bad art. And don't we have to say, what is the quality they get from it? And I know part of the answer, not the whole answer, lies in the fact that they're discriminating quality that often belong to a different medium. And storytelling pictorial art is a beautiful example of that. Storytelling pictorial art is not necessarily bad art. Some of the greatest paintings not only in the West, but elsewhere, is great by virtue of its literary as well as its strictly pictorial qualities. But all the same, people will enjoy a bad picture that tells a story because they tune in, as it were, on the literary quality of the picture. And at the same time, literary quality will tend to be inferior as literary quality. Or they'll enjoy bad art because they confuse the aesthetic satisfactions one can get from experience at large. And there are such things. With the art immediately under focus. that is, they'll associate a poem, a picture, a piece of music with aesthetic satisfactions that don't belong to any of these mediums. Well, that's a question I want to take up at greater length later on in the seminar. It's where I'll be treading on shaky ground, because I'll have no one to guide me. As I've said, the best philosophers of aesthetics have tended to exclude the question of bad art from aesthetics. I mentioned Croce, even Coleridge, and even Kant, somehow, who knew how important it was, but somehow felt, I guess, unable to deal with it in his time. Well, there's where I'll be striking out into the blue. But for the time being, let me get back to taste. As I said last night, taste isn't subjective. And curiously enough, I can't prove that any more than I can prove what I think is good art is good. But as I think came out partially in the discussion last night, if you assume that taste is subjective, you'll find yourself running into absurdities. So we have a sort of negative evidence that taste has to be objective. And as I said too, the past shows that there has been a consensus of taste over the ages, that those who spend the most effort, the most time attending to a given art, usually end up by agreeing in the main and disagreeing only at the fringes. And those who attend most to art try hardest, tend in the main to be people who, whether they know it or not, cultivate their taste. People who cultivate their taste too, they point where it's least, they're least distracted in looking, listening, reading by irrelevancies, where they're least distracted and least blocked. All this seems to me so obvious, so self-evident. Everything I've said to you this evening in the past 15 minutes seems to me something that we should all have taken for granted, known was to be taken for granted before we came here. And yet, I bother to labor the obvious, because my experience has been, as I said at the outset, that this question, the question of being able to discriminate quality in art, seems to be one that it's improper to touch on in public nowadays. And in that, you know, at the same time, I still feel apologetic for bringing it up. It's as if I were insulting their intelligence. And it's also as though if you want to make any general point about art in this time, you have to bring this elementary question up and go into it in an elementary way in order to begin the as a preliminary to the discussion itself. After all, there are artists today, and have been for the past 50 or 60 years, who say that they're not interested in the question of good and bad in art, or as far as they're concerned, they've never seen any bad art, or heard any bad music, or read any bad literature, or seen any bad buildings. And so, it's as though you're challenged to, you know, there's a point blank challenge to come out and state this rather elementary, these rather elementary truths, this rather elementary truth is just one. As I've tried to tonight,
if taste is only objective, is there such a thing as naive taste?
I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I think it depends on if I want to use your words or your way of using the words you choose. It seems confusing to me that someone, I mean, this is kind of what Lenore was talking about last night when you tried to decide whether, you know, over subjective, objective, and taste. But you started to talk about cultivating taste, or that's really where taste gets going, is that you make a statement of taste, and if someone challenges it, or if it's challenged by something you read, you go back and reconsider the experience, and then your taste develops over a period of time of familiarity and looking and experiencing. But somewhere it has to start, and is the original, you say your first response, which would be a naive response without maybe too much information, a response of taste, or is that something else? That's what I'm trying to ask.
Oh, I think the first response you make, say, as a 3-year-old child to music, or as a 2-year-old child to storytelling, taste starts operating, like in the, when you start looking at pictures. Even though you may look at pictures to see the funny man in there, the funny animal, not the picture as picture.
Right, but at that time, taste is operating, but is taste, it seems to me that at the beginning, taste is really subjective, and only over a period of time does it become, after cultivation, objective.
I would tend to agree with you.
Okay, well, but I thought you were saying that it could only be objective. I misunderstood.
Very good point. Yeah. At what point does taste become objective? Right. I never thought about that. And nobody I've read ever thought about that either. And that, I suppose, comes under the heading of what makes bad art bad and what makes bad taste bad. See? And you can cop out on that by saying, well, undeveloped taste is bad taste. And this, I now begin to see, is what caused so much confusion to aestheticians.
That they
recognize that people in the course of developing their taste, or in the at the point where they stop developing a taste, they're guilty of bad taste, and then they say, well, what has this got to do with taste? And they get confused and throw the thing out.
That's because they're only using taste subjectively.
Yeah, and then they say, well, taste is subjective, they say at that point.
or is only subjective.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I've tended to just point to the record and say, well, the way art, formalized art, actually gets handled by society would show that good taste is decisive, by and large. And I've just been watching that. And the life of art itself, even in the most decadent periods, is governed by the operation of the best taste going.
But isn't the question of taste always up for grabs? I mean, it's something that you have to, in a way, re-experience every time?
Right.
That the art object, say, is open to question of taste at all times?
Right, but that comes in most crucially, I'd say, for people who have developed taste. That's a later stage. Ellie's got a point here that I guess nobody's dealt with that as far as I know, and I'm not sure I know how to deal with it myself.
Well, maybe it'll come up from hitting it on some other side.
Maybe.
Perhaps you could answer it by telling us when art, when taste became objective for yourself.
That's very good too. I think it. I think at the point where I stopped being afraid to say what I thought about anything, being afraid to report my reaction to anything, and I'd say at that point when I reached that point of honesty, that new point of honesty, I'd say my taste was now exposed for correction by further experience, by other disagreement on the part of other people who said, well, I disagree with you, and then I was sent back to look at what the work of art that was the object of disagreement. Something like that. But see, I've tended to answer that question on the basis of the record, the results. See, and I'd say that for me, my taste became objective. It became objective only long after I died. If some of my judgments survive, and posterity goes back to the works of art I like and goes back to the works of art I don't like and agrees with me. And when I say posterity, I mean the people who try hardest when it comes to art in the future. You know, the people who try hardest, look longest and so forth, and are most on the level. If they, let's say, in succeeding time, agree with me, that will show my taste to have been objective. Because, again, I go by the record, we can say that the people who, in Rome, decided that Leonardo and then Michelangelo were the best artists in the neighborhood in the early 16th century, at a time when there was some reluctance in Florence to give these artists commissions, Michelangelo and Raphael, and where there was Julius II, Pope Julius II, showed no reluctance at all. He immediately saw that Michelangelo and Raphael were the best artists around at that time, and brought them to Rome. Well, Julius II, taste has turned out to be objective in time since.
I think there's a distinction that ought to be, or at least I'd like to make a distinction between showing something to be objective, time showing something to be objective, and time making it objective. I think that when posterity returns to what you've said about art, that won't so much prove that your taste has been objective, but that will objectify your taste.
I disagree with you point blank there. You're making it a matter of opinion. See, taste in art, value judgments in art, aesthetic verdicts are not matters of opinion. That's exactly what I mean when I say objective.
I know, I mean that's exactly why I disagree.
There are ties and fashions and so forth. Raphael wasn't thought so much of 30 years ago, but by a lot of people who should have known better. But they were wrong at the time. And there were people who knew they were wrong. And you realized that these people were not exerting their taste sufficiently to achieve objectivity. It's like someone this evening said to me, I'm so glad to hear you like Dante. I happen to read Italian in a whole thing way, and well, you have no right not to like Dante if you read Italian. You just don't have the right to. You have no right not to like Shakespeare if you read English.
But I think it has something more to do with the uses that our culture makes, or not so much our culture, but the civilization makes of certain ideas.
That may be so, but it nevertheless remains. What you say may be true, but in this connection, it's a superficial truth, and it doesn't really affect the case that much. If you read Greek, I take it, if you read ancient Greek, you have no right not to like Homer. And experience, which is the only court in this matter, the only court of appeals, the only Supreme Court, bears this out all the time. If you read enough English verse, you read it with the proper attention, and you say, what is the proper attention? That's borne out in experience too. You end up by concluding Shakespeare is the greatest English poet. If you don't, the conclusion drawn is that you really can't read poetry beyond a certain point. And that's how we find out that taste is objective. Because the opposite of saying it, the opposite, to say it's subjective, turns out to be absurd.
I think you're very close, but I think that it's really a significant misuse of the word objective.
For lack of a, it's not scientific objectivity, it's not probative objectivity, as I said last night.
No, not that. It's not that.
But it's not subjective. We're here caught between two terms, subjective and objective. And objective is much closer to the truth than subjective.
Isn't that just the point? You seem to want to make it more of a truth than subjective. Anything that's subjective can always be discredited as being somewhere in a corner, not to be considered very seriously. But objective, that sense of objectivity, seems to give it bared out of having.
No, I don't mean that. I'm not being rhetorical here. I'm not. No. I'm arguing.
Well, why do you dislike
subjectivity
so much? Obviously, you don't want.
Because
subjectivity.
When you bring subjectivity in, then there's no barriers.
Anything can be said.
That's right. And it, I can, if I, in my bad taste, decide I like a certain piece of music by Joe Smith, better than I do anything in Mozart. Well, that's my subjective opinion. And then, if there's no objectivity involved, I can go along safely believing that Joe Smith is a better composer than Mozart. And we know that isn't the way it works out. Experience, the whole past shows that this isn't the way it works out. I'm not trying to legislate something. I'm trying to point to the way art has been dealt with in the past, and the way art has worked itself out. And all the evidence shows over the long term that the verdicts of taste, provided taste is sufficiently developed, have been objective. And we can find out where taste has been sufficiently developed. The ascent of generations of connoisseurs.